You're listening to Fix Me a Drink, a Flaviar podcast.
Welcome to another edition of Fix Me a Drink. I'm your co-host, Noah Rothbaum. We have an incredible rye-focused episode for your listening pleasure. We'll first have on Heaven Hill's West Coast whiskey educator and ambassador, Jack Choate, talking a little bit about one of my favorite ryes, Rittenhouse Rye, and its current popularity and importance to the Heaven Hill portfolio. And then following that, conversation with me and my co-host David Wondrich and legendary bartender Audrey Saunders about how they both got Rittenhouse listed in New York about 20 years ago, got it first available here, and how that helped kick off the rebirth of the cocktail. We'll get Jack on the line now. Welcome, Jack. Thank you for joining me today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Noah. Excited to be here.
Today's episode, it's obviously all about Rittenhouse and its return and how it sort of kicks off the cocktail boom. I mean, I think it's hard for people to believe that Rittenhouse wasn't always widely available.
Yeah, 100%. I've been in the industry now a little over a decade. And when I came in, it was definitely to crashing sounds of where's all the Rittenhouse? Why can't we get more? And fortunately, those screams and yells and requests were heard. And over the time of really the last 10 years, we no longer really have that issue.
Why do you think there is such a demand for Rittenhouse from bartenders and whiskey drinkers?
I think that when the craft cocktail boom kicked off at the turn of the 90s into the 2000s, when bartenders, you know, primarily initially in New York, and then as it spread west to San Francisco, maybe stopping in Chicago a little bit, you know, bartenders were finding these 100-year-old, 115-year-old tombs with cocktail recipes, and then they were calling for rye. And, you know, fortunately for us at Heaven Hill Distillery, you know, we had recently acquired Rittenhouse through one of our many acquisitions of historical brands. And Rittenhouse was the one that seemed to fit the bill for everyone. You'd rather be lucky than good. We were extremely lucky and fortunately very good.
How important do you think Rittenhouse has become to Heaven Hill in terms of portfolio and its reputation?
Oh, I mean, it's very important. You know, I found myself in the great city of Salt Lake last week talking to the USBG there, the United States Bartenders Guild. Fantastic cocktail scene, actually. I had an absolute blast and we were talking about it. You know, that without Rittenhouse, I may not be there. I may not be having that conversation with bartenders. You know, even though Heaven Hill celebrated 63 years, if I'm doing my math correctly, 64 years, the year that we acquired Rittenhouse in 1999, we weren't having all those conversations with bartenders prior to that. I mean, heck, was anyone in American whiskey having many conversations with bartenders in the 90s? I'm not sure. But Rittenhouse set the stage for where we are as a distillery, you know, as we refer to it in the industry, having that discussion with the on-premise bartenders, restaurants, Rittenhouse working so well in craft cocktails, rye being featured in the recipes for craft cocktails. It's wildly important to us in that conversation and in that discussion and being part of that great community that is bartenders and the folks making drinks for the general consumer.
Yeah, and I think that we kind of take for granted the fact that rye is now ubiquitous, right? You could walk into any liquor store, into any bar, and, you know, you can find it, forget one bottle, but usually a shelf of rye whiskeys, right? Which, I mean, if you'd asked me 20 years ago, you know, it seemed like a small miracle to find, you know, any kind of rye anywhere, right? I mean, even in New York, where you're supposedly be able to get anything, right? It was still very hard to track down a bottle of rye. And it seemed sometimes like almost like a myth that it existed.
For sure. I mean, you say 20 years ago, I would probably even say, you know, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
it's amazing to me. I'm actually reading a book right now called Last Call, The History of Prohibition. And it's like the mention of rye, you know, before Prohibition was all over the place. I mean, rye whiskey was the first whiskey of these United States.
When we look back at the history of distilling in America, bourbon folks, your colleagues often like to say, you know, America's native spirit, which is a little bit of, I'm not going to say a lie, but bending the truth here, because obviously folks were making rye before they were making bourbon in the U.S. And obviously we were drinking rum before that and all types of apple brandies. But right. You look at like George Washington and Mount Vernon was, you know, then, you know, after he left the White House for several years, you know, in the late 1790s, he has a rye distillery, right? Which just shows, you know, how deep the rye roots go back.
I believe he was the largest distiller in the country at that time.
That's what Mount Vernon claims, and who am I to disagree with them about that? But I mean, I would certainly say it's incredible that the grain has endured and that people are, you know, still enjoying that sort of spicy flavor that rye usually has. And Rittenhouse certainly full of all types of amazing baking spices. To prepare for our conversation, I was sampling some the other day, which is not unusual for me. And, you know, it's amazing how many different flavors, you know, you really get out of the Rittenhouse rye.
You know, going back to your question about why does it work so well, why have bartenders fallen in love with it, why does it work so well in cocktails? It is because of all of those great flavors that it has. You know, it's you mentioned that it's full of rye. It's 51% rye. So it's hitting the minimum of the standards in the U.S. standards of identity to be a rye whiskey. 51% rye, 35% corn, and 14% malted barley. We actually refer to that as a Kentucky rye mash bill, of course, because it has 35% corn. I think it's also referred to historically as a pre-prohibition style rye. But the way that 51% rye, that 35% corn, and the 14% malted barley works after 4 years in a charred brand new oak container that has been charred, it just develops those fantastic, round, robust flavors. It works great in a cocktail, works great in that situation as a neat pour as well. So, you know, the really exciting thing is how much rye we're making now at Heaven Hill than we were previously.
Thank you, Jack, for coming on. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Noah. Thanks for having me.
We're going to go deep now into a new section, a new segment of the podcast. Bring on Dave Wandrich and Audrey Saunders, a legendary bartender, talk about how they both got Rittenhouse listed in New York about 20 years ago and sort of the craft cocktail boom. We'll continue the Rittenhouse rye conversation coming up. Cheers.
Cheers, man.
Welcome, Audrey. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, Audrey.
I am thrilled to be here. It is so good to see you both.
Likewise.
Dave and I, you know, I feel like we're always talking about rye whiskey. It's nice to have you both on since you both really played such a big role in bringing back rye whiskey to New York and really the rest of the country. It's sort of hard to believe dark days we lived through as rye whiskey drinkers. I mean, it was, you know, you could barely find it. And even in New York, where you can buy anything in New York, but like it was very hard to buy rye whiskey. I mean, Audrey, when you started Pegu Club, it opened up in what year? That was like
2005.
Before that, you'd been working in New York, obviously, for a number of years with Dale DeGroff and Bemelman's, different restaurants and bars.
Well, I mean, especially at the Bemelman's bar, which was that was very exciting for everybody when you got that gig.
Yeah, we used to Bemelman's. So the Carlisle, they weren't related properties, but they shared a lot of the same clientele. So they would send me on a number of times. They'd send me over to London to do pop-ups at the Ritz London. And on the last trip, which was 2004, I was with Dick Bradsell and Tony C. Dick was taking us around and he said, let's go to this place called the Crowbar. And we went to Crowbar in Soho, and it was this super cool, like it was a shoebox of a size, and it was a super cool heavy metal bar. And if you looked everywhere, like one of the walls at that point was just lined with coolers just filled with Alka-Pops. But like on the wall, there was this shrine. There was like this little shrine to American whiskey, and it had this bottle of Rittenhouse. And Dick was like, well, let's give that a go. And so we got a round of Rittenhouse, and it was so good that I got really angry because mm-hmm. I thought, why can't we get this? Because at that point I was also looking for other rye for Bemelmans. But by and large, you know, at that point, you know, the hotel wasn't necessarily a call. The clientele was very international. So there was like a lot of equal amounts of bitters being poured in martini, you know, not even martinis like the classic cocktail, but martini on the rocks was a call. So, it wasn't the focus and it was just fine. But I remember, you know, even trying to search it out for the Carlisle in 2004. And I worked the purchasing director and we couldn't find it.
The way I got involved with it was in, I think, something like 2002. I went out to California and my friend Ted Hay, Dr. Cocktail, the famous guy, you know, Johnny Cocktail Seed, I went over to his house and he had a little party and he pours me some of this really good rye. And I'm going, hey, that's good rye, you know? And he goes, yeah, I know. And it's like, I can't get that in New York. He goes, no, we get it here though. And so I got it and I went and found a bottle. I made my wife go with me to about 8 liquor stores in like Hollywood and Beverly Hills where we were staying in that area with our little, 5-year-old in tow. And finally I found a bottle and I brought it home to New York and I was very happy. And so, this stuff was great. And this is like 2002, maybe. And then 2003, I started doing consulting on bars and with my friend Zach Palaccio, who was a chef. And I looked around and no, we couldn't get this stuff in New York. But by then I knew Larry Kass, the press guy at Heaven Hill, who made Rittenhouse. And I called him up one day and I had the power of Esquire magazine behind me because I was the drinks guy for Esquire. And that was a good gig to have because people read the booze column there and distillers had heard of Esquire and they thought it was classy to get talked about in Esquire.
Absolutely.
So I called Larry and I said, you know, I'm doing consulting now and I would love to get this stuff listed in New York. Something has to be listed separately in every state with that state's liquor board. It's not one listing fits all.
And you just can't ship it right from the distillery to a bar. It has to go through a distributor.
Exactly. So he goes, well, you know, I'll think about that. I'll look into that. And I said, well, you know, I've got some consulting gigs coming up. At the time, I thought I was going to be doing drinks for the Plaza Hotel and doing them for the Oak Bar and their other bar. But then the manager moved on, and so that fell through. But that would have been a lot of leverage. But no, that didn't happen. At the same time, I said, and Larry, can you send me a couple bottles of Rittenhouse because I'm going to write about it for Esquire, which I did. Except the stuff he sent me, he told the warehouse guys to send me it. And this is how unused to anybody asking for anything about this brand they were. They went down to the warehouse, his shipping guys, and they saw what was in there. And they go, Esquire magazine, they don't want the regular stuff. They must want this other stuff that had a neckband on it that said 10 years old.
Wow.
And it turns out that was made for the Maison de Whiskey in Paris and some store in Tokyo. And he ships it to me and I've got this 10-year-old stuff and I'm tasting it and it's absolutely delicious. So I call him up and I said, Larry, how can you sell 10-year-old rye for $14 a bottle? And he goes, well, what do you mean 10 years old? And I said, well, it's got a neckband that says 10 years old. And he's like, what? And he finally figured it out. But that was, you know, the state of like rye then. It was, nobody was paying much attention. But anyway, to make a long story short, finally he got it listed I think in early 2004. And I was doing drinks for this place, Five Ninth, which was a restaurant in the beginning to be trendy meatpacking district. And I used it in our house drinks. I've still got the employee manual I did. This was May 2004, this thing opened.
Right.
And it says our house rye is Rittenhouse bonded. Quote, this has recently been listed in New York, but they might not have it in stock. It's worth bugging them for. And in fact, they didn't have it in stock when we opened.
I remember. I think I was at the opening party.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that too. Yeah.
We called them, you know, and we said, well, I thought you had it listed. And they said, yeah, call the distributor. We sent it to the distributor. And we called the distributor, who was this company, Paramount/Eber. And they say, no, it's not in the warehouse. Then we called back and forth. And this is over the space of a couple months.
Paramount was a boutique.
Yeah. And they just didn't have it until I ran into Linnell Smothers these days. Nowadays, Linnell lives in Birmingham, Alabama, where she runs the lovely liquor store. Then she was running a great little liquor store in Brooklyn, like in Red Hook, the far end of Brooklyn. And she goes, oh, yeah, I got all that stuff. I was in the warehouse. She's, you know, she's from Alabama. And she was in the warehouse with her liquor rep, who she was friends with. And she goes, what's that? Can I have it? And he said, sure. So she got it all. And without telling us, you know, nobody at Eber or Paramount kept any track of it. So they, it was a big mystery. So that was kind of where we finally were able to get some, I guess, at the end of 2004. And I think that was when we split a case with you guys as you were gearing up for Pegu Club.
No, it was 05. So 04 was when I was still at, Bellman's then. And that's okay. That's when I was over, you know, in London with Dick and Tony. And that's when I had it. Okay. And then when I came back, we looked for it and we couldn't find it because I really wanted to have it as well. And so when, you know, obviously the changing of the guard 2005, and I left the Carlisle at the end of January. And mm-hmm. I started putting together the spirits list and, you know, okay. and the ways and all the ways.
That for Pegu Club. Yeah.
Yeah. For Pegu Club.
Yeah.
Which opened obviously on Houston Street and on the second floor. Is always kind of a home away from home, little bit of.
My God, what a sight that was.
Yeah.
The first time you walked in, it was like, oh, you don't have to make little tiny speakeasy bars. You can make huge bars with all the booze in the world.
Huge bars for New York, right?
I mean,
right,
like, I only know from huge bars. Right. I mean, yeah. Really, like I'm from the Waterfront Ale House. You know, and then doing, you know, and then going to Blackbird with Dale and, you know, and we were doing a lot of volume there. And then we were volume in Beacon and volume downtown at the Tonic. Like it was all I knew. I mean, I couldn't fathom like a smaller bar than that. So it was just, you know, you just want a bar that everybody can walk in. Like yeah, that right. was always the thing. You got to walk into a bar. I don't want to have, you know, I mean, unless you're a large group, you know, and then maybe we'll take the reservation for 8 people at 5 o'clock, but I don't want to, you know, if you want to stand at the bar, I want you to stand at the bar. Yeah. You know, that's just how it is. You put your foot up on the rail and you stand at the bar and, you know, and you enjoy yourself without being, you know, having to be ushered away from the bar because you're standing. But that's another conversation into itself. So the second, you know, I mean, I left Carlisle, you know, really wanting to sink in because, you know, this was going to be, you know, in my head, I really wanted this project to be a game changer for everybody. And so I was like, all right, you know, like I started. So I, you know, after we opened the accounts with the distributors, I was working with Rob Schwartz. He's at Southern, and at that point he was director.
Yeah, Southern's a big liquor distributor.
And so basically, Rob and I worked super, you know, super closely together. And I had told him, you know, very clearly about, you know, about the Rittenhouse. And I had also reached out to Larry Cass down at Heaven Hill. Mm-hmm. And I said, Larry, I said, we, you know, I said, I told him, I was like, I'm kind of pissed that like, why can't we have nice things in New York City?
Yeah.
And, And I said, I'm opening Pegu Club and Dave's over at 5/9th. And, you know, we really, really want this product and we will, you know, we will be more than happy to commit to an entire pallet. And he giggled. He's like, yeah, no problem. He says, we got tons of this stuff in the warehouse. And I'm so tickled pink about it. And that was May, it was probably like February or March, because May was the time when Heaven Hill, when Southern got Heaven Hill as an account. And so it rolled over from Paramount.
You know, it's funny is I've got my updated drinks for 5/9th from May 2005, a year after we opened.
Yeah.
And it says, you can get this stuff from Paramount without anything about it being hard to find.
Yeah.
So by then, I guess, you can get it from Southern. And so by then, I think because of your pressure largely, here's the problem with 5/9th is it sold a lot of drinks, but they were mostly vodka sodas or a very fancy house drink. They didn't sell a lot of whiskey drinks. It wasn't a whiskey drinking crowd. So
there was New York wasn't a whiskey drinking crowd at that point, really.
Yeah, at that point, we were selling, you know, club drinks as much as anything there. And, you know, some of the highballs I had on the list.
But that's what it was. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
They didn't know any better at that point. I mean,
no, they weren't drinking Manhattans so much.
They weren't drinking Manhattans. They anything we started to serve at Pegu in the very beginning, it was like, can I get it with vodka? Can I get it with vodka? Even ginger ale, can I get it with vodka? And I'm like, yes, you can. I said, we'll make you one with vodka and you'll have that one first. And then I'm going to make you one with gin, which is on me. And I want you to taste them side by side. And you tell me, and they're like, yeah, the gin's better. You know, so every single step of the way was that.
Well, you know, to be fair to these people, all they'd ever had is under-stirred, under-vermouthed, warm martinis that taste nasty. To this day, I can't drink those. You know, the ones where there's two drops of vermouth, or you just wave the vermouth bottle cap somewhere or put it on the radiator or some stupid crap like that.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of bad bartending that had to be kind of walked back.
The bartending was great. The mixology was thrust upon bartenders. They didn't know any better.
No, nobody taught them. Nobody showed them.
Swimming upstream. I mean, I got to say, when I was working, you know, when I was working with Dale at Blackbird, I mean, we were, I can't tell you how many, you know, apple martinis, cosmopolitans, vodka, you know, dirty vodka martinis. It was just like pouring over the bar. But, you know, he had a special touch. And even with that, you know, the sales of specialty cocktails with gin and rye and Amari, you know, those also excelled, you know, but it's a gentle hand.
But it also helped, I think, at the time that you taste these drinks and, oh, they're good. If you're using a 100 proof rye instead of an 80 proof rye in your Manhattan and a straight American rye instead of a Canadian blended one, when you mix that Manhattan, you do, you know, standard two parts rye, one part sweet vermouth, a couple dashes of bitters. Let's just use that as a baseline. And people try that and suddenly they go, oh, that's actually good.
You can't even imagine today what it was like, right? I mean, Heaven Hill was making rye one day a year.
Actually, you can imagine what it is today because it feels like with all of the teenies that are being served right now and all of the dirty, it feels like exactly
it's true. Dirty Martini is back, baby.
It's it, man.
I'm waiting for apple teenies again, and at which point I'll just, you know, retire to Italy and darken these shores no more. I'll be like the elves leaving Middle Earth.
Oh, yeah. We're not letting you go anytime soon, my friend, okay?
But at least this time with the teeny, you know, you can never get rid of the teenies. They're always going to come back. They're like skateboards. It's cyclical, right? But at least this time, you can get rye. People know what rye is. When you open, I mean, Pegu, this is like the pinnacle of bartending in America, right? There are just a few bars that are doing the types of cocktails that you were doing at Pegu.
And nobody on that scale.
Cutting edge. This is like, you know, this was what Dave and I and Dale DeGroff and others were praying for, right? That finally, right, we had as crazy as it sounds, New York City finally had real cocktail bars again, right? That, you know, weren't serving martinis made with chocolate mm-hmm. syrup, which was something that people would do. Real cocktails with rye, right? And this was one of these things where even if you mentioned rye, people had no idea what you're talking about. It had fallen so by the wayside that people, even if you asked for it, they didn't even know what you meant. Like, you know, or they would just look at you like you were nuts. Like, why would we have rye?
And also they didn't know what to do with it.
There's a line in Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, and he says, yeah, we're all God's madmen, you know? And I feel like we were all God's madmen back then, because I looked at, you know, and you and I, you know, we exchanged, you know, notes and texts yesterday. I'm going to read Rob Schwartz again, who was he worked with Southern, and to give you an idea of the madness, because I had asked him, you know, for like specific dates on, you know, when it switched over from Paramount to Southern. And he says, I think it was first listed May of 2005, because that's when Heaven Hill launched with us. But we only had a tiny amount of inventory and you were getting ready to open. I can't remember the guy's name from Heaven Hill you had reached out to, which is Larry Cass, obviously. But he made sure we put in a PO for 52 cases, a full pallet, in order to have it here for your opening. And I'm saying that because, you know, I mean, we have it, you know, we from you and to me, we have a timeline. Yeah. But more so about the 52 cases, because that's, you had to be both insane and fairly confident.
That was all the rye in New York. You know?
Those were 12 bottle cases.
There's buy and hold, okay? Yeah. Buy and hold, you know, from a bar. It's like you had to buy those quantities and they would hold it for you. So when you think about it, I'm just about to order the 52 cases of rye in 2005 when everybody's drinking a Cosmopolitan. It's pure insanity. And you have to think, man, you know what? This better work. I mean, this... We really want people to drink it. But that was the thing, like, you know, like the cocktail scene as it was in those years, it was so like firmly rooted in, not that there's anything wrong with vodka, but that's where we were at.
Yeah. All the other stuff was all dying, and it was all like, so many things, products had been moved to hospice, basically. Right. Like rye was one, you know, things like Orange Corso. Totally. Yeah. Gin was edging towards, you know, and gin, they were already kind of looking at its room and figuring out what they could put in there. So it was really... swimming against the stream to bring these things back, because nobody wanted to work that hard to educate on what now I got to teach customers what rye whiskey is, what I ain't never done before.
I don't even think that any of us would have believed it, right? I mean, it wasn't that we wanted rye to challenge bourbon or rye to be popular. It was just the simple hope that one day you could walk into a liquor store and get a bottle of rye. I mean, it sounds ridiculous. I mean, the bar was that low. That was the dream, right? Like, I could walk into a bar and say to a bartender, can I have a Manhattan made with straight American rye whiskey? And that was the dream that we all wanted, right? And it seemed, to be honest, laughable. Like, I never thought we'd get there.
Well, I always used to tell my friends then, I was still an English professor, and my friends would say, why are you doing this writing about booze and cocktails and stuff? And I said, well, because I want to be able to walk into any decent bar in America and order Manhattan and have a properly made Manhattan. And I'd look at them very seriously, and then I'd burst out laughing, because that was never going to happen. Right. That was just ridiculousness. You know, that was the joke, is like, this is gonna catch on. No, it wasn't going to catch on. I was doing it because they paid me. You know?
We knew it would catch on, though. We did.
Well, that was the hope, right? We had to believe that.
Well, and if it didn't, at least we were drinking well, and you know, we were having fun, you know, and every year we got more people coming and joining us.
I mean, look, it's one of those things too, where I think we're very fortunate, because not only were you able to convince Rittenhouse or Heaven Hill to bring Rittenhouse to New York. But Rittenhouse is also, it was 100 proof as is today. It's bottled in bond. It was, you know, kind of the perfect rye for people to taste, right? Who had never tasted rye before, right? It's full of flavor. It works beautifully with vermouth.
Rittenhouse was so smooth. And you just know that when we were getting it back in 2005, like you just know that, you know, when you think about, you know, the 4-year age statement, that was the minimum in that bottle.
It was at least 6 years, that stuff.
By law, the age on a label is just the minimum. You could put in older stuff and say, and as ridiculous as it sounds, a lot of whiskey producers at the time had so much inventory that they were getting, they were putting much older stuff in bottles of the younger statement. Or if the younger stuff sold out, not a problem. We'll just substitute the older stuff because they just needed it to leave the warehouse, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. That was just, I remember opening that bottle and going, oh my God. You know, I mean,
yeah, it was rich and mellow. I still have one of those bottles that I've saved.
Wow.
Yeah. One of the early 2000s Rittenhouses.
Us too.
Yeah.
Well, what were some of the Rittenhouse cocktails, Dave, that you put on the menu at Five Ninth, and Audrey, that you put on the early menus of Pegu Club?
Well, at Five Ninth, I had the Tombstone cocktail, which was based on when Audrey, you and I and a bunch of other people went up to Woodlawn and found Jerry Thomas's grave. And we had actually Julie Reiner did the shaking. We brought a huge shaker and a bottle of rye and shook up cocktails and we brought real glassware. And we all had a toast to Jerry at his grave in up in the Bronx. So that was just a whiskey cocktail, whiskey bitters, a little bit of simple syrup, and you know a twist basically. So that was one. We had the Manhattan. I had this crazy thing, the 19B Smash, which was rye, Jamaican rum, and Grand Marnier shaken really hard with mint. And that was a little too strong, but I didn't know what I was doing.
So. How about you, Audrey?
Yeah, you had a bunch.
Yeah. So when it switched over to Southern, for whatever reason, there was this long delay because in fact we didn't get it at opening, and we didn't know there was a hiccup in whatever was going on, and I'm like,
same thing, yeah.
Where is it? Where, you know, Rob, he's like, I don't know, you know, and then it finally, you know, when it washed up on the shores of Southern, you know, I remember we just ran, and this is probably like mid late September at this point, I want to say, because, and I was also talking to Shad Solomon. And we were talking about the same thing, you know, we were talking about the Rittenhouse story.
And he was on the opening team, right?
And he's like, I remember when it came in, he says, because we were all running around behind the bar, switching out all of our whiskey recipes, you know, or whatever we were using, bourbon or whatever we were using, for Rittenhouse, you know? So it was just, it was almost like the baby Jesus had come, you know, we were cradled around the mangers, like super excited.
I remember having the Manhattan Pegu and, you know, I mean, what people don't realize is that the bar was like a star factory, right? Or a talent incubator, if you will. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, every bartender who came in there, right, literally has gone on to incredible things. And seemingly every one of them created some kind of rye whiskey cocktail with Rittenhouse, right? They all wanted, you know, it was almost like some kind of, you know, rite of passage, right? First, it was like to work behind the bar at Pegu was like you had made it. That was like Broadway, right? So you're like, and then the next step was like, you've got to come up with a Rittenhouse cocktail that not only was good, but that Audrey liked. That was good enough to put on the menu. And if it could go on the menu, then it was like the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Like, you know, you had made it. Like, and that was always interesting.
Then you would see it made everywhere.
It was, and it was, but I'll tell you, and this actually speaks for the, you know, the Rittenhouse speaks for itself here, because I really wanted to have the Rittenhouse for Little Italy, but I did not impose it on anybody else. Like, it was just that good that everybody's like, wow, like, cannot believe how effing good this is. Like, I am totally inspired to create. And that's really what happened. But I think because, you know, I mean, we used to do some super razored in exercises, like, you know, it's, you know, have like three or four bartenders behind the bar and say, okay, you know what, everybody's going to make their version of a Sazerac. Okay. And you get this whiskey, you get this whiskey, you get this one. Right. And you have to, what I want to taste is your adjustment on the bitters for all of it. How many dashes are you going to use? How are you going to balance it? You know, and then they would all switch the whiskeys, you know? So if you had this, you know, whiskey, you had to make it with that one. So to their credit, you know, I mean, that's why when you, you know, I mean, it was that kind of education, you know, it was important to me that if you're going to go out into the universe, that you have the skill set to be able to do whatever it is you want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what the focus was there. It was really, you know, I tried to make a finishing school, but these amazing, amazing human beings, they got it, you know? And so I did the Little Italy, and I'll come back to a funny story with the cherries there too. But even shortly after that, you know, and it started this whole dynamic of, remember when we were doing like all of the neighborhood cocktails. So we had the Manhattan and we had the Brooklyn, and then Enzo did the Red Hook, you know, and I'm like, you know what, I'm doing Little Italy, you know, because of my ingredients with, you know, everything except like the American rye. And then, you know, and then Chad, you know, in the spring came up with the Bensonhurst cocktail, you know. You know, and then Phil Ward came up with the Final Ward, and then, you know, and then Chad and I did a flip on the Diamondback, which is the Copperhead, you know. And so it was unto itself. Rittenhouse was just completely
insane. I used it in, I had a drink around that time called the Old Bay Ridge, which was an old fashioned that was split between Rittenhouse and Lini Aquavit. Because Bay Ridge used to be full of Norwegians and Irish, and the Irish drank rye and the Norwegians drank aquavit. Yeah. So that was fun.
That sounds good.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah. Well, what's in rye bread, right?
Right.
Rye and caraway. Restaurants weren't doing it then. It wasn't. Now every restaurant has a cocktail list.
Now they have to, like, in order for them to have game, they've got to have, like, they have to have a beverage program.
This was big news. Like, nobody knew what an old fashioned was. People had heard of a Manhattan, but like never would order it. So like, but the point is that, like, as people wanted to get into this industry, folks from other cities would come, I say 5/9 and then definitely Pegu. They would sit at the bar. They would have the cocktails, they would try things like Rittenhouse, and then they'd go back to their cities or countries and say, you know what I had? Like, you know, I've had bourbon Manhattans, but now I've had a rye one, and maybe we should serve rye Manhattans. You know, so it was just, I mean, it was kind of a place where people could go and finally taste things that they'd only read in cocktail books, myself included, right? I mean, it was one of these things where I don't think any of us ever believed, reading through all these books we'd find in libraries or used book sales or flea markets, that always, you know, we dream about maybe what they tasted like. And then finally at a bar stool at Pegu, you could not only say like, yeah, I'd love this cocktail, I'd love a Vieux Carré. You'd say, great, coming right up. And it was like a dream, right? Yeah. And it was one of these things that then folks, again, it sounds ridiculous, but it was so exciting and so like groundbreaking that you could finally try these drinks. Some of them I liked, some of them I didn't like, but it was just incredible that you could actually try.
That bar was like, it was like one of the great New York hotel bars, but without the hotel up on top of it. You know, it was like a long bar with, you know, lots of tables and seats. So there were private spaces where you could sit and talk with people. You could just go hang out at the bar and you never knew who you were going to meet. Every traveler, every bartender from around the country was coming in, or every, you know, drinks person or cocktail geek. And you'd always run into somebody that you knew either in person or by reputation. Yeah. And so it was a real like clearinghouse. The tribes moved through there. And that was the greatest part, is not only were the drinks amazing, but the people were amazing.
It wasn't. It wasn't just about any one bartender. You know, that's the great thing. It was about all of them together. And it didn't. You're okay. Like, obviously, everybody's got a favorite, you know, to a degree. But it was the kind of bar where you even if your favorite wasn't there, you didn't care because you had a great time, because the other ones were just as fabulous. You know, everybody in their rights. You know, funny, witty. You know, just,
and they could make each other's drinks. Most importantly, like, you know, you could say, "So and so's not here. Can you still make that?" Absolutely, of course. It tasted great.
That was the one thing that, you know, in the beginning, it took a little while, but they caught, all the bartenders caught on. And it's like, you know what? It truly is about consistency, you know? And that's why in the bar meetings, like, somebody would come up with a creation, but we would all taste it and we would all comment and contribute. But that way it was also, everybody took ownership of that person's drink.
That's really important. Yeah.
You know, because it's like, again, it's like, you know, fine dining. It's like, you want to make sure that dish is consistent on a, you know, on a Sunday night or a Thursday night. It's got to stay the same. The other thing about, you know, before opening there, and we talked about like what the state of the cocktail was, you know, I remember, you know, again, it was just, you know, there was just such a degree of insanity, because we understood, like they, you know, not just myself, but all the bartenders understood, we all wanted this to work. Like, we wanted this whole, you know, craft cocktail thing to actually stick. I mean, that was the dream. And so everybody who was there was signed on. They knew that they would be educating as well. And to their credit, they were all amazing educators in their own rights. But we knew that once the doors, if you think about New York then, you know, place opens downtown, it's very trendy, it's fashionista. It was fashionista versus foodie, right?
Right.
A lot of the places open, and the fashionistas got there first, which was, you know, almost frightening, because, you know, then you'd have this huge popularity contest, and then it would crash and burn because they'd moved on to the next one.
Yeah, it would be empty in like 8 months.
Yeah, so I tried intentionally to keep it off the radar, but also the cocktails in this, you know, again, sounds nutty, but it's true. They had to be perfect. Like, they had to be amazing. They had to be delicious, because if you read about the opening, oh, okay, another place is open. It's like, oh, amazing drinks. You read about the amazing drinks and you go there and they suck. Well, you're going to be like, wasn't all that. Yeah. You know, done. All right. You know, we lived the dream. We're done, you know, next. And if it had been the next, like, if that had happened, if it was any less than delicious or amazing, then it would not have stuck. You know what I'm saying? Because we all knew that it was a platform, and you know, this is it, you know, man, this is like your time. You're grabbing the brass ring for every bartender back there. This is the time that we can either make it or break it. And everybody just put it into overdrive and just got it done. And in every single bartender back there, they were just, you know, just rock stars, just, you know, collectively, it was a great band. It was just an amazing band, like how they jammed together.
The bag drinks would not have only doomed Pegu, but it was one of these things where people would never have had a Manhattan again. You know what I mean? Like, that's the set. I mean, that's the pressure that was on you. It was like, you're working the high wire without a net, because, you know, if somebody came in, it was like, oh, I've heard all about these classic cocktails, like, let's try them, and they didn't taste good, that would be it. Like, they would never go to another cocktail bar again.
The upside back then was, like, if you made somebody a classic cocktail right, it was very hard for them to go back, you know, to drinking like their Manhattan with the teaspoon of cherry yuck in there and the teaspoon of vermouth, and then like 3.5 ounces of watery whiskey, you know, I mean. They couldn't drink those anymore. I couldn't drink those anymore.
No, the goal was to try to kind of create a private hell for people, you know,
like, where they want to come back.
They have to come back.
Like, I remember being, you know, when I was with Dale and we were at Blackbird, and I was just, you know, it was the first time, I had worked with him on gigs, but I got to learn from him. And I just remember those stellar moments when he made me the first caipirinha, the first mojito, the first Singapore Sling. And I'm like, what is this? Like, I've never had this. This is amazing. Like, these profiles are amazing. Like, and I knew it, then that was the point when I said, you know, I'll work for free. You know, I want to be the best I can be. Like, I'd never experienced this. And that was my private hell. Like, my private hell was like, okay, I don't want to drink anything else now that I've had the candy.
Yeah,
like,
I don't want any of that crap.
I don't want any of that. You know, so we put the car in drive, and like, it was about like just making cocktails as delicious as humanly possible, with clean lines and structure and form, and just really allowing, like Dale's, the first time he served me a whiskey sour, and I was just like, oh my God, like, I can't believe this.
Yeah.
Like,
is there anything better, you know?
This is what fresh lemon juice is like.
That's what got us all here. I mean, I think I remember seeing Dale at Blackbird, you know, having lunch there is the first time I met him. And, you know, I was 22. I had never really had many fine cocktails at the point. And I was interning at Food and Wine with Pete Wells, who just started. He was associated. And he was like, let's go visit my friend Dale. And I was like, okay, sure, whatever. And that, you know, blew my mind. And then taking like a course with Dale at the Marriott Marquis and, you know, making all these classics. And what's hilarious is that all of the classics Dale had a B version for. So he had a Caipirinha, but he also had a Caipiroska, which he would make with vodka because you had to have, you know, like there was like the real recipe and then the doctored recipe that like you could possibly get people to try, right? So instead of rye, there was the bourbon one, right? But he would make both and be like, and it was just, both of them were delicious, but obviously the, you know, the A recipe with the intended ingredients is always better. And, you know, it was just one of these things where even then, like rye, you know, we would talk about rye in the past tense, like, you know, this was, unfortunately, like you're probably not going to have rye like available. So you're going to have to make this stuff with bourbon. And that's just how it is. And we're going to tailor all the recipes to bourbon. And
not that that's a bad thing, we know, but it's just softer. And there's times when you just want that bite.
Well, I did back then I did for Esquire a little blind tasting. I made the same drinks with 80 proof rye, 100 proof rye, 80 proof bourbon, and 100 proof bourbon.
Yeah.
And the best ones for my palate were the 100 proof rye ones, but the 100 proof bourbon ones were second. You know, it wasn't just about the rye. It was also a lot about the concentration. The extra proof gives you flavor and concentration, and
structure.
The drinks aren't as watery. You know, they're.
And that's why I think Rittenhouse, even now, like there's so many, you know, compared to 20 years ago, there's so many, many more people making rye, but you still see so many of the best bars continue to use the Rittenhouse.
Oh, yeah.
I think because of that reason.
Got Rittenhouse in, and we put the Manhattan, and I was so proud of that Manhattan. Like, I was just, you know, I mean, I was just so proud of it because it just, the Rittenhouse was just, I mean, it just sat there and it spoke for itself. And you didn't, this is what I mean with cocktails and the big picture, less is more. Keep the clean lines, you know, few ingredients.
Minimum ingredients to get the effect you want.
Exactly. And allow, and it tell you, like, when you did that, like, the Rittenhouse just sang an aria. I mean, it just sang an aria that I just wasn't finding.
You got few ingredients, but use the ones that do the job and aren't just there because you have them, you know? It's like...
All of this talk has made me incredibly thirsty for a Rittenhouse rye Manhattan. I have to confess. So I think it is probably time for us to mix up some Manhattans. Thank you for coming on, Audrey. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you, Audrey. This was great.
Honored to be here. And it is just so good for my heart to see you both. It's just a special treat for me.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Fix Me a Drink. Dave and I encourage you to always drink responsibly. Cheers.